Some people try to combat it by tying a string around their finger. Other people try to combat it by writing it on a post-it note. Other people try to combat it by jotting down the information on the calendar in their iPhone. What are they combating? Forgetfulness. It's a problem. Chrissy, at my age, I notice it more. I can't tell you how many times I've wandered around the house looking for something that I put down 12 seconds ago. Retrace my steps. I go back to my childhood. I can remember where I placed things then, but I just can't remember anything recently. Forgetfulness. It's a problem. It's a problem at school when you forgot that today was that big test that you hadn't studied for yet. You know, the one that you were sweating about for three nights before when you woke up in the middle of the night. Forgetfulness is a problem at school. Forgetfulness is a problem at work when you forgot the biggest meeting of your career with your most important client and it just slipped your mind. Forgetfulness can be a problem at home when you forget whose anniversary it was yesterday. Forgetfulness is a problem. Things that are truly important are worth remembering. That's why there's a 21st chapter in John's Gospel. We've been examining this summer some encounters that people had with Jesus. And all the encounters that we've looked at up to this point were encounters that people had with Jesus before his death and resurrection. And the emphasis in those encounters was Jesus emphasizing to them the truth about salvation. Well, we want to end this series of encounters by looking at encounters that Jesus had after his death and resurrection. And the emphasis on these encounters is not on Jesus stressing the matter of salvation, but on Jesus stressing the matter of discipleship that Matt was talking about, that he and Alice focus on in their ministry at URI. As a result of that, we can basically think of John chapter 21 as a refresher course in discipleship. Because Jesus will remind us in that chapter of what it means to follow him. What's involved in following Jesus. To teach this course, Jesus is going to use an object lesson that we'll see today. He's going to use some questions that we'll see next time. And then he's going to use an interview that we'll see the time after that. So what can we learn about discipleship from these encounters that Jesus had with his disciples after his death and resurrection? Well, why don't you turn in your Bibles to John chapter 21. John chapter 21. Now, before we actually read a verse from chapter 21, I think it's worth our while to just remember how the previous chapter ends. So take your eyes and scan back a little bit further to the end of chapter 20. After Jesus rose from the grave, he appeared to his 11 disciples on that Sunday evening. All of them were there except for Judas and for Thomas. John chapter 20, verse 25. So the other disciples were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he, meaning Thomas, said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." But Thomas did get his chance a week later. Verse 26. After 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing." Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed." The Gospel of John really reaches its climax with this statement by Thomas, when he declares that Jesus is his Lord and his God. Then immediately after the climax of the Gospel, with that declaration, John states his purpose in writing this account. Verses 30 and 31. "Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book." John said, "I just gave you a little sampling. "But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." What a great way to end this book. You have a former doubter making this declaration about Jesus, that Jesus is his Lord and his God. And then John states his purpose in writing this account, which was just fulfilled in the statement that Thomas made. His purpose was so that people like Thomas could make this declaration. What a great way to end this account. I'm sure if John had an editor reviewing his manuscript and he got to the end of chapter 20, he would have said, "John, great job, it's a wrap, let's just start pumping out these copies." Until John told him he just had one more chapter to write. Why not put down the quill at the end of chapter 20? I mean, I just couldn't imagine there's a better way to end a book than the way he did in chapter 20. Why did he add another chapter to the perfect ending? Because John wants us to know that belief in Jesus is not the end. Belief in Jesus is not the end. Belief in Jesus is only the beginning. Belief in Jesus is only the beginning. Do you know Jesus? Can you say with Thomas, "My Lord and my God"? That is great. That is terrific. But that's not the end. That's just the beginning. What Matthew does in the 28th and final chapter of his gospel, what Luke does in the 24th and final chapter of his gospel, John does in the 21st and final chapter of his gospel. He gives the Great Commission, but he just does it with so much subtlety you may not know it. So let's begin these final three encounters with Jesus. Encounters that Jesus had with his disciples. And we'll begin reading in John chapter 21, verse 1. "After these things," such as his death and his resurrection and his earlier post-resurrection appearances, "Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias," which is another name for the Sea of Galilee. "And he manifested himself in this way." Well, how did Jesus manifest himself again? In what setting? Verse 2. "Simon Peter and Thomas," called Didymus, he was apparently a twin, "and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee," who we know to be James and John, and two others of his disciples were together. That would bring the total to seven. So seven of these disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will also come with you." They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. Sometime after the celebration of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which would end a week after Passover, a little more than a week after Jesus died, and sometime after Jesus appeared that second time to his disciples, on that time when Thomas was also present, at least some of Jesus' disciples had returned to Galilee. Now, that was something Jesus knew was going to happen. He even said it would happen. In Mark chapter 14, verses 27 and 28, Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, because it is written, 'I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered.' But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." Jesus told them that he would meet them in Galilee. And after Jesus arose, the angel gave these instructions to the women at the empty tomb. Mark chapter 6, verse, Mark 16, verse 7. "But go tell his disciples and Peter, 'He is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you.'" I think there were lots of reasons why the disciples left Jerusalem and made their way to Galilee. And one reason was Jesus said he was going to meet them there. That was a good reason. I think there was probably some other reasons that worked too. One is, I think they wanted to get away from the religious leaders who had just killed their Messiah. I think something else was probably going on, and one is, well, what are they going to do with their time? I mean, they had their hopes based on the fact that they were going to help Jesus build this kingdom, and they had a picture in their minds of what this kingdom would look like, and there didn't seem to be anything to do right now. Well, what do you do? Well, you go to what's familiar. Well, most of them live in the Galilee. Why don't we go home? And what are we going to do with our time? We also need food. We got to eat. Why don't we go back to work? And many of them were fishermen. So it was logical for them to go back there. Well, on this occasion, seven of Jesus' disciples were together. Peter, who was their leader, announces he's going fishing. So what do people do when a leader says something? Well, I can think of many exceptions, being in a Baptist church. Well, the answer is not nothing. Okay, the answer is, what they do is they follow. So they go ahead and they follow. They go fishing with them. Now, when Peter goes fishing, announces he's going fishing, he may have thought of this as a temporary thing. Or maybe he thought of it as a permanent thing. It's hard to know for sure, because remember, everything was in a state of flux. And at this moment, what else were they going to do? What else were they going to do? So they go fishing in the middle of the night. Fishing was very common in the middle of the night on the Sea of Galilee. It was the best time to catch fish. Night was pretty frustrating, because they spent the whole night out there and they didn't catch a single fish. It's one thing to cast your line into a pond when you're on your day off and you're sitting in a nice little chair and you're relaxing and you're dozing off. And so what? You don't catch anything. No big deal. You still had a relaxing time out by the pond. But what if you're a commercial fisherman and your life depends upon catching fish, and you spend all night out there and catch nothing? That is really frustrating. Verse 4. "But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet his disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, 'Children, do you not have any children? You do not have any fish, do you?' They answered, 'No.' They didn't recognize it was Jesus at first. Probably a couple of factors. One was the darkness. Sun was probably just starting to come up. We also learn from verse 8 that he was about 100 yards away. So you could understand 100 yards away, dim light. It would be hard to recognize it was Jesus. Maybe they thought this was an eager customer out there who wanted to get some fish, or maybe they thought it was a heckler. Verse 6. And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find a catch." So here's this stranger 100 yards away, yelling out to these experienced fishermen, who I'm sure had egos, telling them, "You're 10 feet off. You know, you got to move from the left side to the right side." How do you think somebody like Peter would have responded to that? The same way Tom Brady responds to my calls when I tell him how to play quarterback. He is just not happy with that. But the restraining order is cut down on my calls. I just want you to know that. Anyway. But if they were frustrated and they were ticked off at this stranger's advice, they must have been frustrated enough to actually follow it. Verse 6 continues. So they cast. And then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Wow. Something fishy's going on here. And I'm not just the only one who thinks that. I think when that moment happened, when they dragged their nets over from the one side of the boat to the other, and all of a sudden all these fish were jumping in, I think a light went on in John's mind. That's why we read in verse 7, "Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.'" I like the way John describes himself as that disciple whom Jesus loved. You know, if you and I were to say that, we could say it with an attitude of pride. "Yep, I'm the one that Jesus loved." I don't think that was it. I think it was just a display of John's humility when he wrote this gospel. His name isn't in. You know, he doesn't identify himself when he appears. But he'll describe himself and with just simple terms. And you know how he thinks of himself? He thinks of himself as somebody who is the object of the love of Jesus. His name isn't important, but who it is who loves him is important, and that's why he describes himself as a disciple whom Jesus loved. And John knew it was Peter. John knew it was Jesus. Now, John seems to be rather insightful. In chapter 20, he and Peter run to the tomb, and Peter gets there before he does. John gets there before Peter does, but in a minute I'll mention again, Peter runs into the tomb. But when John saw the empty tomb, the text says he saw and believed. And here he seems to be the first to understand that this is Jesus on the shore. He's the first one who identifies that, oh yes, that's Jesus. Now, if John was the insightful one, Peter is the impetuous one. Verse 7 continues. "So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea." In chapter 20, Peter was the first one, even though John beat him to the tomb, Peter was the first one who actually rushed in to the tomb. And here, what does he do when he finds out it's Jesus? He jumps in the lake. How many times have people told that to Peter in his life? Tell me. This time, without anybody telling him to do it, he just jumps into the lake. He couldn't wait to get to shore, but he's smart enough to realize, how can I appear to Jesus in my underwear? Because he just had, you know, an undergarment on while he was working. So he puts his cloak on first, and then he jumps into the water. I don't think Peter thought this through quite completely, but you got to love him for his enthusiasm. Verse 8, "But the other disciples came in the little boat." Must have been two boats out there, probably a big one and a little one. "But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. And when they get to shore, indeed they find it is Jesus who is waiting for them, verse 9. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus already had some provisions waiting for them, and he invites them to contribute to what he's provided. Verse 10. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have now caught." And thanks to the instructions of Jesus, they did have fish to bring. Verse 11. Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Quite a catch. 153 large fish. Now that number, interestingly, caused a lot of speculation among the early church fathers as to what's the significance of the number 153. Some people try to tie that number to a list that supposedly existed of all known fish that existed at that time. And that number was 153, but I think the evidence for that is kind of scant. Others look at it a little bit more complexly, with more complexity. They see it as the total numbers of 1 through 17. Total that up, you get 153. And why 17? Well, because 10 is the number of commandments, and they said 7 represents 7 gifts of the Spirit. Now, while speculation is rampant, the only problem is evidence is scant. And if there was a symbolic significance to those numbers, it would seem to me that there'd be a whole lot more evidence and widespread evidence to support that. So in light of the absence of evidence, I would suggest that the significance of the number 153 is this. That's how many fish were caught. And it'd be natural for them to know the number. One is, you know, they're probably like golfers who want to find out what their lowest score is. Fishermen want to know what their biggest catch is. So they're probably thinking, I got to count this. You know, this is bigger than the one we got like 2 years ago. I remember that one. Let's count them. Plus, they were also going to sell them. They needed to know how much to charge. So they would count the fish. And that number stuck in John's mind as he's writing this account. He was there. He knew how many fish there were, and it was unbelievable. 153 fish. Verse 12. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" Knowing that it was the Lord. That verse just gives me a sense that you can still see that everything is just they're just still in turmoil over this. Everything, we know it's him, but we still want to have some questions about him. The last time we saw him, he was in Jerusalem. He walked through this locked door and appeared in the room, and now he's here again. I'm sure they had this confusion in their hearts and minds. Yeah, they know it's him, but I don't know. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. Jesus, who is their Lord, he serves them. And John notes, verse 14, "This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to his disciples after he was raised from the dead." Now, this may mean this is the third time that Jesus met with his core disciples after the resurrection, or it may mean that this is the third time that he's recorded an incident where he met with these disciples, the first two being on the Sunday night after he rose, and then a week later when he met with them again when Thomas was present. Well, what is the significance of this third meeting? I mean, you read this and you think, well, what does this have to do with discipleship? What's the point? What Jesus is doing in a very subtle but extremely powerful way is he's reminding them of their original call to discipleship. He's reminding them in this incident, without preaching a sermon to them, he's reminding them what's involved in following him. Remember in verse 7 it says that they recognized Jesus after the net was filled with fish. I mean, there were probably a couple of factors that made them realize it was Jesus, that made John realize it was Jesus. One may have been the voice. You know, he listened to Jesus speak for 3 years, and he hears this voice from shore. You know, it's traveling 100 yards over the water, and even though the water amplifies, it's still, there's quite a distance. It's still kind of dark. And I think the voice may have planted a little seed in the back of his mind, but it says that after the net was filled with fish, then the light went off. Then he knew that it was the Lord. See, it was the situation. Like Yogi Berra, the Hall of Fame baseball player, said, it's deja vu all over again. This was what was happening. I think John's mind immediately went back to an eerily similar event that had taken place about 3 years earlier. Would you turn to Luke chapter 5? Keep your place in John 21, but turn back to Luke chapter 5. Now, keep in mind what we just read in John chapter 21. Okay, keep some of those details in mind. And now, we're going to read from Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Notice some similarities. Luke chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Now it happened, while the crowd was pressing around him, meaning Jesus, and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, another name for the Sea of Galilee. John 21, they're by the Sea of Galilee. Here, they're by the Sea of Galilee. And he saw two boats, and I think there probably were two boats too in John chapter 21. Remember it mentioned they brought the small boat in? Which implies there's a larger boat too. And he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake, but the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, Jesus got into one of the boats, which was Simon's. Simon was there in 21 and he's here in Luke 5. And asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. Jesus is giving them some fishing instructions. Sound familiar? Simon answered and said, Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing. Sound familiar? But I will do as you say and let down the nets. That sound familiar, following the instructions? When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish. That sound familiar? So that, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet saying, go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were, who else was there? James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, do not fear, from now on you will be catching men. When they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. You know what I think John chapter 21 is? It's a setup. Jesus is setting them up without preaching a sermon, he's using the circumstances to preach a sermon to remind them of his original call to them, and that that call has still not been revoked. One of the most significant events in Peter's life and the lives of James and John was when Jesus called them to discipleship. Here they were, the biggest change in their life. They were fishermen. It's what they did. Jesus says, no more. Now you're going to be fishing for men. Significant event. Everything in their lives began to change drastically after that. They were always thinking back to that event. And now what does Jesus do? He just takes them back in time to remember that event where he called them to follow him. What did he want to remind them? I think he wanted to remind them that disciples follow Jesus. In John chapter 21, Peter and his companions were returning to fishing. Maybe temporarily, maybe permanently. It's hard to know what was in their mind. So what does Jesus do? Vividly takes them back to their original call in Luke chapter 5. How did they respond to that call in Luke chapter 5? Luke chapter 5 verse 11 says, when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. The turning point in their lives. As far as Jesus was concerned, that call had not been revoked. It still was in effect. See, Jesus wasn't simply preparing them for ministry in his presence. Because if he was, he wouldn't appear to them again. What Jesus was doing, he was preparing them for ministry in his absence. He was preparing them to follow him after he had died, risen, and ascended. The call to follow him is still in effect. His death and resurrection, his ascension, wouldn't change one thing. Actually, it was more important than ever for them to follow him now, because Jesus wasn't physically present on the earth. But how was he going to make his presence felt? Through his church. More important than ever, he trained them for this purpose. Jesus also wanted to remind them that disciples fish for people. Remember the initial call in Luke chapter 5, verse 10? And Jesus said to Simon, do not fear. From now on, you will be catching men. In Luke 5, Jesus called them, your ministry of fishing will continue just a little different. You'll be catching people. 3 years later, through an eerily similar miracle, Jesus is reminding them that their preoccupation hasn't changed. They're still to be preoccupied with fishing for men and women. Hasn't changed. And the book of Acts testifies to the fact that that remained their preoccupation. D.L. Moody was approached a man on the street, and he asked the man if he was a Christian. And the man said, that's none of your business. To which Moody replied, this is my business. He knew what a disciple was all about. Disciples fish for people. It's the business of every disciple. Now, it may not be the occupation of every disciple, but it ought to be the preoccupation of every disciple. In other words, it ought to be always on our heart and mind, no matter what we're doing, no matter what we're occupied with in the terms of work, we're still always preoccupied with that thought of fishing for people, of offering to people what Jesus offered to us. There's more for them to remember through this incident. And that obedience leads to fruitfulness. Notice back in Luke chapter 5 at their initial call, Verse 4, when he had finished speaking, remember Luke 5, when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. Simon answered and said, Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets. When they had done this, when they obeyed him, when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish and their nets began to break. They worked so hard. Nothing. But when they obeyed Jesus, an abundant catch, more than they could handle. It says their nets were breaking. Now turn back in your Bibles, if you haven't already, to John chapter 21. Keep in mind what we just read about them obeying his plan. He teaches them that same thing in chapter 21, in verse 3. They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. Sounds familiar. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. The disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, "Children, you do not have any fish, do you?" They answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch." So they cast. And then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Well, what does 10 feet matter? It matters a big difference. It could be the difference between not following Jesus and following his instructions. In a very simple way, Jesus is reminding them, both in Luke chapter 5 and reminding of it in John chapter 21, do what I tell you. If you follow my simple instructions, you will bear fruit. You will get a catch. Jesus is reminding them of an important truth which he emphasized throughout his ministry. Obedience leads to fruitfulness. Would you like to experience the joy of bearing more fruit in your life? Maybe we need to work a little harder at obedience. That might lead to an increase of fruitfulness. Funny, the disciples were out there. They were surrounded by fish. They were just looking on the wrong side of the boat. All they had to do was turn around, take a step, and that's where they were. And I think figuratively speaking, we're off in the same boat. We're surrounded by men and women, but we don't see them. We're just blind to them. But they're there, and Jesus says, "All I want you to do is follow my instructions. I've given you a great testimony to tell. I've given you a great message to share. Let her rip." Remember in chapter 4, Jesus is at the well in Samaria and his disciples come and Jesus tells them, "Hey, the fields are ripe to harvest." They had just been in the pagan city of Sychar. They didn't bring anybody out to see Jesus. This woman brings a whole crowd of people out to see Jesus, but not them. Jesus said, "Open your eyes. The harvest is there." And we need to do that. I need to make sure I'm more conscious of that. I'm always so blinded of sometimes caring for sheep that I forget that there's more sheep that Jesus wants or more fish that he wants in the tank. There's just one more lesson I want to point out that I think Jesus is teaching them through this, and that he is our resource. I don't know if this is significant or not. It caught my attention when I was reading it, but I can't say that this is. I mean, it just caught my attention. In Luke chapter 5, it talks about the net being broken. The net was beginning to break. And here it doesn't mention any of that. It may not be anything. But I wonder if maybe the picture in Luke 5 was that so much the net's breaking. He just wanted to overwhelm them with the abundance. And I keep thinking in my mind, but I don't know that this is true, that there's no mention of that here in Luke chapter 21, in John chapter 21, because I think Jesus just wants to show them, you can handle it all. I'm going to give you what you can handle. You can just keep bringing them in. I think this is also another instance. Well, notice what Jesus does. He invites them to breakfast. Verse 12. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Jesus came and took the bread, and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. I think it's another case of what Yogi Berra would say is deja vu all over again. We don't have the time to go into all the details. But what does this make you think of? To me, it makes me think of John chapter 6, where Jesus took this little boy's lunch, 5 loaves and 2 fish, bread and fish. And he used those elements to feed this hungry multitude. And Jesus is waiting for them there with the same basic elements, bread and fish. I think he wanted to remind them of what the hymn writer reminds us about when he wrote, "All I have needed, thy hand hath provided. Great is thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me." In John chapter 6, he used bread and fish, gave it to the disciples, used them to just spread it out. There was more than enough. They came back with more leftovers than what they started when the leftovers were greater than the sack lunch they started with. And I wonder if Jesus is reminding them, they're looking at the bread and fish. I think they're starting to have more flashbacks. Wow, what a great provider Jesus is. And he's giving them the assurance that this side of the cross, that he's going to continue to provide for them. How would he provide for them now? Primarily through the ministry of the Holy Spirit. As he said in chapter 16, verse 7, "But I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away." How? No way. There's no advantage, Jesus, to you leaving us. That's what they're thinking. "For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you." Wow. I mean, you know what that statement says? That says the Helper is going to do more for you than I can do. Wow. "The Helper will not come to you, but if I go, I will send him to you." No longer physically present, but Jesus would make his impact in their lives just as he always had, even in a greater way. Encouraging. Leighton Ford, longtime associate of Billy Graham, was someone who was sharing the gospel since he was age 14. Spoken to many individuals, spoken to groups of 60,000 people or more, and he said, "Every time I speak to somebody about Jesus, I get nervous." But it didn't stop him. Why not? Because he knew the Lord was with him. The Lord was his resource. And he's our resource. When Jesus first called his disciples to follow him, he met them by the shore of the Sea of Galilee after a frustrating night of fishing and catching nothing. He gave them some instructions, and after they did what he said, they had an abundant catch. And after that display of power and authority, he gave them a new preoccupation. They were to follow him and fish for people. 3 years have passed. He trained them well. He died. He rose. He was getting ready to ascend. So what does he do? He meets them by the shore of the same Sea of Galilee after a night that they had been out fishing and caught absolutely nothing. He tells them what to do, and after they do it, they have a great catch of fish. And then he welcomes them to breakfast. Why? To remind them that their preoccupation has not changed. They are still to follow him and fish for people. They are still to obey him and bear fruit. And he will still be their resource. 20 centuries later, we're reading these stories again. What does Jesus want to do through the scripture today? He's using these two incidents as a refresher course in discipleship for us. He's reminding us that belief in him is not the end. Belief in him is only the beginning. He's reminding us that as disciples, we have been called to follow him and fish for people, to obey him and bear fruit, and to depend upon him, our resource. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do now?